This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
August 28, 1963. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivers his iconic I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial.
It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment, this sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning.
250,000 people flooded the nation's capital for the historic March on Washington. It was a march for jobs and freedom. Some 4,000 of them traveled from Boston, one of the largest contingents of marchers from any American city. They came to hear Dr. King, and they returned home with the message delivered by March director and the Dean of American Civil Rights Leaders, A. Philip Randolph.
When we leave, it will be to carry on the civil rights revolution home with us, into every nook and cranny of the land. And we shall return again and again to Washington in ever growing numbers until total freedom is ours.
This weekend, thousands of people return to the National Mall to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And tomorrow, President Obama will speak from the same spot where King stood at the Lincoln Memorial.
So now we're going to spend some time talking with Boston area marchers who were there in 1963, and also some of whom were there this weekend. And we're going to talk about what it was like 50 years ago and where we are today, not only in Washington or America, but in Greater Boston, an area with its own complicated civil rights history. So we'd also love to hear from you. Do you remember the 1963 march? Were you there, or did you hear it on the radio, or maybe see about it later on television? What was it like for you? Were you here in Boston? And what was the unfinished work, or what is the unfinished work, of the March for Jobs and Freedom? That work that's left to be done here in Massachusetts and the nation as a whole. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now in the studio is Sarah Ann Shaw. She's a lifelong civil rights activist and Roxbury native. She was a television reporter for WBZ-TV for more than 30 years and was the first black reporter at the station. She was at the March on Washington in 1963. Sarah Ann Shaw, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Pleasure to have you. Also with us in the studio is Jane Bowers. She's a longtime Bostonian and community activist. She was active in the school desegregation movement in Boston, and she was at the March on Washington in 63 as well. Jane Bowers, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And with us from Chicago today, Michael Curry. He's the president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. He was at this weekend's commemoration march in Washington, D.C. Again, he's in Chicago today. Michael Curry, welcome to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you. So, Sarah Ann Shaw, let's start with you. Take us back to what you first saw when you arrived in Washington on that August day in 1963.
Well, I didn't go down on a bus. I went in a car, and I took my daughter with me. And the thing that I remember most was so many people. I don't think I'd ever seen that many black people, because the crowd was predominantly black. And I didn't think I know I hadn't seen that many black people in one spot in my whole life, because Boston didn't and doesn't have that kind of population. Mm. And it was just, people were happy and people were sad, not sad, but they were serious. And it was just sort of an overwhelming feeling of being there and being surrounded by all these people and seeing all the signs that indicated where people were from. You know, it's like, whoa, what's going on?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've spoken with Congressman John Lewis, who was the leader of a major civil rights group as a young man then, who spoke on that day as well. And he had mentioned to us how they had met with the president, President Kennedy, that earlier in the summer before the march had been fully planned, and there was a worry about violence that could break out in the nation's capital. Was there any feeling throughout the day of any discontent that could have led to that? Because obviously no violence occurred whatsoever.
No. I got the sense that people were there to do business, to change things, that they were serious. They came because they were serious, because they wanted to see some changes in the laws of the land and the way people treated other people.
Yeah. So where were you, physically located on the day when the speeches were given?
My dear, it was 50 years ago. I don't have that map in my head anymore, but I just know I was there.
And by the end of the day, after A. Philip Randolph gave his speech, John Lewis, Dr. King, Mahalia Jackson sang, when it all wrapped up, what was the feeling that you had then?
Hope. We thought freedom was going to be tomorrow. That was really the whole thrust of, it wasn't just jobs and freedom. The freedom was the important thing. People really thought tomorrow all of these things that have been holding people back, that all the obstacles are going to melt, and we're going to come together, and we're going to do things together, and people are going to be nice to each other. Ho, ho.
And that feeling of hope, you came back to Boston with that?
Well, yeah, I came back to Boston with it. But, see, I had been involved with civil rights groups for a while, and we knew that it was going to be a hard fight, but we thought we could win it.
Hmm. Well, Jane Bowers, I want to turn to you, but before I do, I want to have us hear a little bit more sound from that day, August 28th, in 1963. And first, let's hear a little bit more from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., about the role or the inclusiveness of that day in terms of the 250,000 people who came and who were marching for jobs and freedom. Let's listen.
We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people, for many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny.
And this was a message that many speakers on the day gave out. I was looking at a Philip Randolph speech. He says that he said that day that the civil rights revolution is not confined to the Negro, nor is it confined to civil rights. For our white allies know that they cannot be free while we are not. That message was also echoed by another speaker of the day, Rabbi Joachim Prince, who was at that time the president of the American Jewish Congress. Let's listen to that.
And not for the sake of the Negro, not for the sake of the black community, but for the sake of the image, the dream, the idea, and the aspiration of America itself.
So Jane Bowers, is that what drew you there, that it wasn't just the future of black Americans at stake, but rather what America meant as a whole?
Well, certainly. We are the United States of America, to quote our more recent leader, President Obama. It certainly felt like it was an American issue to try and make equality for everyone, to make a fair and just future, and that it was welcome to participate. I'm white, but I felt very welcome while I was there. Well, I felt welcome when I got on the CORE bus at 125th Street and in New York.
You went from New York.
I went from New York. And I felt welcome as we drove all the way down, as we saw people on the side of the road and at the stations at the turnpike in New Jersey standing outside and waving at us. And it was very, very largely black people, but there were a good number of white people, and I certainly felt real comfortable.
Who'd you sit next to on the bus?
I sat next to a young man who was an encyclopedia salesman. And we talked a lot about encyclopedias and wisdom and justice, and it was a good ride.
So you went from New York, but then when you it wasn't that long after 1963 that you moved to Boston permanently.
Right. Yes, in 1965.
Okay, and so tell me what Boston was like for you then in 65, after the great groundswell of the 63 March.
Yes. As Sarah Ann said, it felt like hope. It certainly felt like hope. And for me, with the kind of narrow vision that I have as a white woman, I felt like everything's just going along fine. We did win. There's going to be justice and freedom for everyone. But as I was moving to Boston, and I had young children, and I was looking at the schools, the turbulence around making schools equal became a big part.
Which was actually one of the specific demands made in 1963 for desegregation in every school district
in
America.
That's right.
Well, Michael Curry, you're the president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. First of all, let me ask you, when you hear these memories from Sarah Ann Shaw and Jane Bowers, what does it make you think and feel?
I think I had an opportunity. Of course, I know Sarah Ann very well, and Jane and I have known each other over the years. I love the oral history. I love, actually, for many of us who are younger, I'm 45 in about a week and 2 weeks, I'll be 45, to be able to attach real stories of people who were there in 1963 or who was around Boston during busing. I was a young child, to share their perspectives on the struggle is moving for me.
Mm. And you hear how both Sarah Ann and Jane were talking about how after that day, when the march ended, they both felt this resounding sense of hope. Now, when you were at this weekend's commemorative march, do you think that that same sense of hope was there throughout the day?
I think it was. I think the reality is I always look at this from a historical perspective. So 1941, A. Philip Randolph had planned a march against FDR over defense jobs, that African Americans were locked out of defense jobs. And FDR, in response to the threat of a march, passed Executive Order 8801, which allowed for diversity in defense contracting. That also led to the Fair Employment Practices Committee. Fast forward to 1963, John F. Kennedy was sort of tarrying, on the Civil Rights Act, and the march of 200,000 people coming down to D.C. may have been just the momentum that was needed to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and eventually the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to this past weekend, we have new issues. They're really the children of those issues from 1963, but we have Stand Your Ground laws in the wake of the Trayvon Martin murder. We have racial profiling, which is rampant and existing in cities and towns all across this nation. And then we have the weakening of the Voting Rights Act with the decision, the Supreme Court's decision on Section 4. All of that is where we are today, and I think the momentum is there after this weekend to all come back and get involved.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a little bit of some of the speakers from this weekend's commemorative march that also happened on the National Mall in Washington. First of all, we have some tape from Cory Booker. He's the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, and now also the Democratic candidate for for senator in New Jersey as well. He spoke this weekend in Washington, and this is what he had to say.
When the leading cause of death for black men my age and younger is gun violence, we still have work to do. When we still have a justice system that treats the economically disadvantaged and minorities different than others, we still have work to do. When you can, in America, work a full-time job plus overtime and still be below the stifling line of poverty, we still have work to do.
That's Cory Booker speaking this weekend in Washington. The Reverend James Forbes was also there this weekend. He's senior minister emeritus at the Riverside Church in New York City. Let's listen to him.
To keep quoting the I Have a Dream speech and not acting resolutely to do something about it is hypocrisy.
All right. So I'm going to ask you, all three of you, this question. First of all, Michael Curry, is there something to what the Reverend Forbes is saying, that that there's still a level of hypocrisy in America when it comes to how we celebrate 1963 but live with racial issues today?
Yeah, I think it's a natural tendency of Americans to want to celebrate history but not to dig deep into what the lessons that were intended from those circumstances. I often remind young people when I talk to them that the civil rights movement was a historical minute ago. So if you think about Jim Crow at that time, if you think about the segregation, if you think about the abuses within all of our systems against African Americans and many others, that was only a generation ago. So if you realize that, then you can sort of put where we are in context. And I think, to his point, we're having conversations about this great speech, the I Have a Dream speech, but absolutely certain that if Dr. King were here today, he'd ask us, you know, what are you doing celebrating my speech when you're not doing the work to deliver on the dream?
Mm. Sarah Anshaw, you were shaking your head yes.
Oh, yes, I agree. I think that the I Have a Dream speech made people feel good, but it didn't really outline any action. I mean, people used to talk about the level playing field, but I think that field is still very fallow because people really aren't looking at the entire picture. The other thing is many younger people don't have the historical perspective of what this country was like and why there was a need for a March on Washington then and a need for one now.
So you don't buy it that we're in a post-racial America?
Oh, not at all.
Hmm. Jane Bowers?
No, nor do I. Things have happened, things continue to happen that need to have attention paid to them. The heartbreak of the death of Trayvon Martin at least has opened conversations. It made people I know who want not to talk about how this is not a post-racial America realize that we must talk about it. Hmm. We have to have the courage to accept there are things wrong that need to be changed.
But we can't just look at a Trayvon Martin situation. I think what happened up at Dartmouth with students having a party that portrayed Bloods and Crips without knowing how Bloods and Crips really changed the lives of so many people with killings and things like that, that where there's still that kind of insensitivity in this country and young white people don't understand and older white people don't understand. It's not just about getting... It's being acknowledged. It's being a person, being seen as a person who is important too. And I think until we can get to the point where young black people understand that they have a very strong, important history that they need to know, and whites need to understand that it's not just about violence, it's about living.
If I can just add to that as well, there's a Rosalind Brock, the chairman of the NAACP, in her remarks at the march, said something at the end of her speech, which I always find piercing. She always finishes her speech with this, which she says, courage will not skip this generation. And she was talking about the student protest, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and those folks that sat at Woolworths. She was talking about the Freedom Riders. She was talking about the many folks, the countless names that many of us have never even heard of before, mm-hmm. who fought against the injustices of that time period. And she's saying that we need that courage today. And I think that's the message that resonates with me, is we need the folks who are sitting in corporate America to say, hey, we will not stand for discrimination within our organization. Mm-hmm. We will not stand for law enforcement violating the rights of citizens of color and mass incarcerating young black and brown boys. We need that kind of courage from white, black, and other citizens, and I think we can get there.
Listeners, I'm speaking with a group of Bostonians who were either at the historic March on Washington in 1963, or one of them, Michael Curry, is of the young new generation of civil rights leaders. Michael Curry is the president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and also with us is Jane Bowers. She's a longtime Bostonian resident and community activist, and Sarah Ann Shaw. She's a veteran television reporter for WBZ-TV, the first black reporter at the station, and a longtime civil rights activist and Roxbury native as well. I've got a couple listeners on the line, and I want to get to them in just a second, but Sarah Anshaw, you said something that got me thinking. Is, you know, talking about insensitivity and lack of historical awareness amongst young people, or maybe not so young people anymore today. But I'm wondering, on the one hand, the nation has made a lot of strides forward since 1963. I mean, Boston itself, through its own struggles with civil rights, has made strides forward. We've got laws on the books, etc. Is it tougher now to say, here are the distinct goals that we need for civil rights than it was in 63? Is that part of the problem?
It may be tougher, but I think that people really, they really don't understand, but it's subtle. It's the subtlety of what is going on that people don't often recognize, both people of color and white people. They don't understand that this is wrong, or this is helpful, or this is harmful. Mm. And I think until we develop a way to make people really understand what this really means when it happens or when it's said. We're going to keep on the same merry-go-round.
Let's take a quick call here. Hugh is calling from Newburyport. You're on the air, Hugh.
Hi. I just wanted to interject a little historical footnote here that back in the 60s, at the time of the March on Washington, I happened to be a newsboy in Haverhill at the time and delivering the newspapers, and I used to like to read the paper. And the march got my attention, and I remember at that time it really started to bubble up in the little in our little town. You know, what's going on down there in D.C.? Wow, this is a kind of interesting. And subsequently, in my community in Haverhill, and some other communities, I believe, all around the country, there were support, little support marches in support of what was happening both that day and I believe during the tent city demonstrations which followed. And I remember my mom saying to me, gee, what are you doing tonight? I said, oh, there's going to be a little march in support of the demonstrators down in Washington. She said, are you going down to that? I said, yeah, I think I am. I went down, there were probably about 20 of us walking around in a circle quietly, and there were about 20 or 25 people just kind of sitting on the fence watching us and wondering, well, what is this all about? And I just remember that period as a time where, because of the civil rights efforts that were being made, kind of the message got out, even into communities like mine in Haverhill, where at the time there were really very few black people. Mm-hmm. And it was really an inspiring time.
Hugh, thank you so much for sharing that story, and thank you for your call. Let's return to the history a little bit here, because I'm looking at the original program from 1963, and under the big headline, Why We March, it says, we march to redress old grievances and to help resolve an American crisis. That crisis is born of the twin evils of racism and economic deprivation. They rob all people, Negro and white, of dignity, self-respect, and freedom. And it's that twin evil I want to focus on a little, and the half of it we haven't discussed yet, and that's economic deprivation, because it was a major part of the march for jobs and freedom. And maybe the person who most impassionedly, with the greatest passion, brought that message to the mark was A. Philip Randolph. Again, he was the director of the March on Washington, labor organizer, and the dean of leaders of the civil rights movement. And he said during his speech that there is no future for a society in which 6 million black and white people are unemployed and millions more live in poverty. This was him in 1963.
Nor is the goal of our civil rights revolution merely the passage of civil rights legislation. Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens, but those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them. Yes, we want a Fair Employment Practice Act, but what good will it do if profit-geared automation destroys the jobs of millions of workers, black and white?
So Sarah Anshaw and Jane Bowers, take us back to Boston in the mid to late 60s about this question of economic access to the American dream. Let's begin with you, Sarah Anshaw. What was it like for black Bostonians?
I was just thinking, I remember when the first black woman got a job running an elevator in Jordan Marsh, that was a big deal in Boston back then. There was talk of freedom and equity, but it wasn't parity. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about parity because it wasn't really stressed that there has to be economic opportunities as well. And you get so drunk with the idea of freedom, you don't understand that freedom really means economic freedom and jobs, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I didn't grow up with seeing blacks working in banks. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up seeing black. There were three black bus drivers when I was growing up.
In all of Boston.
Yeah, who were in all of the MBTA system. Mm. And we knew, everyone knew who they were. Mm.
Jane Bowers, when you moved to Boston, you moved to the South End, right?
Yes. Well, eventually, after a year or two, we moved to the South End. One of the things that struck me when we moved to Boston was what a poor city Boston was. Certainly seeing it, the South End was so incredibly poor at that time. But Boston had high levels of unemployment for decades, from the 20s through into the 60s when it began to change. And people were fighting for the last scraps, which I think is one of the reasons that the school desegregation was so difficult, because people were not in a situation where they saw general opportunities opening up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's pretty helpful to have economic expansion going on.
So, Michael Curry, let's draw a bridge to your work today, because, for example, over the past 60 years, black unemployment nationwide has been roughly twice the rate of white unemployment. That is something that hasn't really changed in more than two generations. I mean, so
right.
So how much has the economic picture here become, you know, at the center of the modern day civil rights movement?
I think we want to make it an individual thing, but I often, again, remind people that we're only a historical minute out of the civil rights movement. So you're going to see the vestiges of race and racism in our society today, and the economic development piece is a great example of that. My mother and her mother could not have had the same jobs that white Americans had. My mother often tells the story about moving here as a teenager from Alabama to Boston and not being able to gain access to employment. And having really relegated to domestic work. So she worked at the hotels in the park, the Copley Plaza area. So those barriers had an impact on a generation and a generation or two post the civil rights movement. If you think that it's post-racial, I think it's a clear argument to be made to anyone who's ignorant enough to believe that the unemployment rates are twice as high. And the deaths of disparities, the illnesses that we're suffering from, people of color, African Americans, on almost every disease you can think of, the despair within our communities, the lack of jobs, the lack of job opportunities, the quarry, being denied access to employment because you've been incarcerated, the over-policing of our communities, all of that is a very simple argument to be made for why this is not post-racial.
So Michael and Jane and Sarah Ann, I want to play one last piece of tape as we sort of barrel towards the end of the segment here. And let's return to Dr. King, because this is one aspect of his speech which isn't discussed all that often, but I think it's a great place for us to end. So Dr. King, 1963.
We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism.
So we just literally have a few seconds left, but Sarah Ann Shaw, do you feel like we need to have that same fierce urgency of now today?
Certainly, because I think if we don't have the urgency, if we don't get people of all ages to understand the urgency, we're not going to move forward. Mm-hmm. We may inch forward a little bit, but we're not going to move forward.
Jane Bowers, last quick thought from you?
I think urgency is essential, and I think that have a chance to take a breath and start again with the same urgency that was evident in 1963.
Michael Curry, I've heard you said a couple times that it's been just sort of the blink of a historic eye, and yet 50 years is still a long time. Do you think we're going to have to wait another 50 years for a major move forward, for the next wave forward?
I think that's all up to your listeners. You know, we have a challenge ahead of us, and I always say, you know, the time is now. So if we all focus on these issues and take them seriously and get involved, we can change it.
Well, Michael Curry is the president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, speaking with us today from Chicago. Michael Curry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Jane Bowers, longtime Bostonian and community activist. She was at the March on Washington in 1963. Pleasure to speak with you, Jane. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Sarah Ann Shaw, lifelong civil rights activist, Roxbury native, and the first black reporter for WBZ-TV. She was there for more than 30 years on BZ and also at the March on Washington 63. Pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for coming in.
The first black woman.
Black woman reporter. Thank you so much for the correction. Fact-checking always to the end. Listeners, let us know what you think about race then and now in America and in Boston at radioboston.org. Stick with us. There's more of the show in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.